Only half a day's work on Wall Street, but a long day if you work in retail. And we learn more about the economics of climate change. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Kai Rizdal. It's November the 23rd. Thanks for joining us today. Let's start off with our weekly wrap of the economic news that came up this week, some of which dropped just this afternoon. For that, I'm joined by Kate Davidson of The Wall Street Journal, who's here with me in the studio, and Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post, on the line from Palo Alto, California. Thanks to you both for coming in on a holiday weekend.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
So we got some typical holiday news drop on a Friday after Thanksgiving, the fourth national climate assessment with new details about how climate change is already affecting us, will in the future, and lots of economic news in there, Kate.
Yeah, I mean, if you've been following, I suppose, all of the data on climate change, this report's probably not that surprising, but it still paints a really dire picture. The upshot is that climate change is essentially going to cost the U.S. economy billions of dollars by the end of the century.
Hundreds of billions,
right. As much as the GDP of many states. And there were a few conclusions that this report drew. One was that climate change eventually will disproportionately hurt the poor. It could broadly undermine human health, damage infrastructure, limit availability of water. There's all kinds of things that we're actually already seeing. I think that was another important point that the report made. And like a lot of reports on climate change, they pointed out that this could, there are actions that could be taken to curb some of the impacts, but that if we continue on the current path, it's going to affect a number of sectors of the economy, everything from agriculture to energy. So, again, pretty dire.
And Catherine, what do you think is the likelihood anything is going to be done with this information? Even though it came out from Trump administration agencies, it's a congressionally mandated report.
I think the likelihood that this administration will do anything is zero, as evidenced by the fact that they chose to release this report today, Friday, Black Friday, on a day when basically all Americans are out shopping and they're with their families. This was deliberately released on a day when it would get buried, reportedly weeks ahead of the planned schedule, precisely so that it would get buried. And that is enough to tell you exactly what the Trump administration thinks about how much consciousness they'd like to raise about these very dire issues.
Yeah, all that remains to be seen. But since you mentioned it, let's talk about Black Friday. You've got two big retailers out of the game this year, Toys R Us and Sears. What is the retail landscape even looking like this season?
Well, it's interesting because retailers are actually, they're feeling pretty good about sales. This is projected to be possibly one of the best holiday sales seasons in years. Consumers are probably feeling good. Jobless rates continue to go down. Raises are going up. And of course, we had the tax cut earlier this year that's, supposedly helping consumer spending. So things are looking good heading into the holiday season. That's not necessarily translating to higher profits for retailers because their costs are going up. We have a number of factors there. The transportation costs are rising, labor costs are rising. Those rising wages that I mentioned are, that's a cost to these companies. They're also spending more on sprucing up their stores. They're investing in the brick and mortar operations, whereas they had been putting in a lot of investment into online operations before. So it's kind of a mixed picture if you're an investor and you're looking at these companies. But if you're a shopper, it's pretty good because there is so much competition. They're lowering prices. I think there's a lot of good deals to be had if you're a shopper.
I will add that there's another cost that I don't think was mentioned that could be thinning margins, which is tariffs. And to a large extent, these big retailers got in their orders before the tariffs that the Trump administration imposed took effect, but not necessarily all of them. And it'll probably have a bigger cost to the add cost to them more next season as opposed to this season if those tariffs are still around. But that will also weigh at least on some of these retailers.
And just because we're talking about trade, very briefly, Catherine, what about Brexit? The UK and the European Union have a big meeting coming up on Sunday to hammer out some additional details. Are we going to get anything meaningful out of this?
out of the meeting on Sunday, it's a little bit hard to say. One thing that's bizarre about this so-called Brexit deal is that it seems like everybody dislikes it, except for perhaps Theresa May, the Prime Minister of the UK. People in her party don't like it. People in rival parties don't like it. Fellow members of the EU have come out against it or have threatened to come out against it. Spain is one of those. Angela Merkel has said some things that seemed like she was a little bit out of step with the deal that the EU came to. So just because there's a meeting on Sunday, even if that actually gets the rubber stamp, if it is in fact just a rubber stamp from these EU member states, it doesn't necessarily mean that this is a done deal because it still faces many hurdles ahead within the UK as well as around the EU.
Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post and Kate Davidson of The Wall Street Journal. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was a short trading day here in the US, but there was plenty of action in the markets. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Talking about Black Friday still, Toys R Us was not among the stores where shoppers lined up for deals today. The toy chain shut down earlier this year, laying off tens of thousands of workers without severance. This week, private equity firms KKR and Bain Capital said they'll contribute $20 million to a compensation fund for those employees. The move comes after months of former Toys R Us workers pressuring the private equity firms to pay up. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports.
When Toys R Us shut down in June, a lot of people lost their jobs, like Deborah Meisen, who lives in Ohio and worked for the retailer for 31 years, most recently as a store manager.
I was forced to go on Social Security, which is half of what I made as an assistant manager in the store.
Meisen, who's 66, has been looking for other retail jobs, but she can only find seasonal work. And what she's hearing from potential employers isn't encouraging.
When January comes around, if we choose to keep you, you're going to get 5 hours a week. Nobody can live on 5 hours a week.
Meisen and other workers thought Toys R Us would pay them severance. Carrie Gleason at the workers' advocacy group Rise Up Retail says that was the retailer's policy.
And so everyone was absolutely shocked in March when they found out that the severance policy was being, you know, thrown in the garbage by the bankruptcy court and that they weren't going to get a dime.
So Rise Up Retail helped the workers calculate how much they were owed in total, $75 million. Then the workers put pressure on the retailer's private equity owners. They made their case to the boards of the pension funds that invest in those firms. Workers say the $20 million from KKR and Bain Capital is a huge victory. Sarah Woodhams, who worked at a Toys R Us in Pennsylvania, says it'll help her pay some bills and buy Christmas presents for her daughter.
KKR and Bain have helped us. They're doing the right thing. But we are owed $75 million. That is what the severance would have cost them.
They're asking for the rest from the third Toys R Us owner, Vornado, and from the creditors who own the Toys R Us debt and led the bankruptcy process. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
And now to sports. The National Football League had to cancel a game that was supposed to be played in Mexico City on Monday night. Apparently, there were poor field conditions. The league has already announced another game will be played in Mexico next year, but growing a sport outside its home country can be tough, as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports from Mexico City.
Outside a Mexico City restaurant called Lalo, Daniela Montemayor stands in line, waiting for a table. She lives in Monterrey, Mexico, and traveled here to see the Kansas City Chiefs play the Los Angeles Rams at the Estadio Azteca.
My boyfriend is a huge NFL fan, and so we were really excited, and he bought us tickets. So we were going to go also with two other friends.
She's upset that poor field conditions at the stadium in Mexico forced the game's relocation to Los Angeles, but she says she definitely tried to get tickets next year.
I am willing to go because part of that's bothering me is that I do think, if it's true of the field, that it was our fault.
Her boyfriend, Fernando Torres, standing next to her, says this experience left a sour taste in his mouth.
If it was canceled this year, what's it to say that next year the same thing doesn't happen? Doesn't look good for anyone.
especially not the NFL, a league that's trying to expand its international fan base by bringing teams to other countries for games.
That's definitely a business play.
Mark Hyman teaches sports management at George Washington University.
There are limits to the number of tickets you can sell and jerseys you can sell to Americans. And like all other professional sports leagues based in the U.S., it's aggressively looking for opportunities globally.
He says the converse is happening too. The English Premier League soccer is growing in popularity stateside. This year, NBC says its soccer broadcast reached almost 40 million U.S. viewers, an increase of 14% from last year. In Mexico City, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
San Mateo County in California sits between San Francisco and Silicon Valley. The recent wildfires in Northern California did not reach the area. The county is one of the richest in the state, but it's also home to one of California's poorest towns, Pescadero. 1,700 people live in the community of wooded hills and open fields perched above the Pacific Ocean. But as Scott Cohn reports, that beauty comes with a price.
As the crow flies, or the seagull, Pescadero, along the Pacific coast, is less than 20 miles from Silicon Valley, but by just about every other measure, it is a world away. This is where the techies go on the weekend. Some have homes and ranches out here. Tourists flock to the quaint downtown. But Pescadero itself isn't wealthy at all. The Census Bureau says its median household income is about $43,000 a year, less than half the county's overall figure. 13-year resident Rita Mancera takes me on what she calls her reality tour.
Once you start getting a little bit out of the downtown area, I think that's when you start seeing some of the reality for other people.
Mancera is director of Puente, a nonprofit social service organization. There hasn't been a lot of new development in Pescadero for decades. Many of the jobs here are in the farm fields that surround the town. She drives us by some of the housing for those workers. She points out a trailer with no windows intact.
Look at this. I mean, really. Seriously.
The local school district is short on tax revenue. Over at Pescadero High School, it's lunchtime for 100 students in a school that has no safe drinking water because the well is contaminated. So they use bottled water. Amy Wolliver is superintendent.
We often say that we are out of context for the county that we live in. Because of our rural nature, we have infrastructure problems that others don't understand.
But the lack of development here and the low tax base can be linked to the very organization that helps give Pescadero its charm.
We're being loved to death by it.
It is the Peninsula Open Space Trust, or POST, a 40-year-old nonprofit based in Silicon Valley that buys up land to save it from development. Walter Moore is president.
You would have many, many more second home luxury development. And so you would have an area that was locked up for private use rather than public use.
POST owns about 7,700 acres in Pescadero. Trouble is that when it buys land, it qualifies for a tax break because POST is a nonprofit. Take a 1.25-acre parcel right on the Pacific Ocean worth about $2 million. POST will pay about $400 in property tax this year. Bob McKeon is a local real estate broker and a lifelong resident.
People in the area really do not favor POST. They feel that POST is an absentee owner and they're not supporting the local community.
By all accounts, POST land in Pescadero is worth more than $50 million. If that land were in private hands, it would bring in about $200,000 a year in tax revenue to the school district. But POST pays only about $45,000. And Superintendent Wolliver points out that doesn't account for all the land POST has bought in the past and transferred to tax-exempt agencies like the state parks.
It's off the tax rolls essentially forever.
The county is helping some, kicking in millions for infrastructure, including a new well for the high school. POST is trying to help, too. It pays an additional $55,000 a year to make up for some of the lost taxes, and it's funding some new housing. But Moore says that's not what POST donors are paying for.
post-Roland mission is the protection of the rural and ag heritage. That is our mission. That's our vision. We believe it. What makes this area unique.
Locals love the open space, too. They just wonder sometimes if it's worth the price. In Pescadero, California, I'm Scott Cohn for Marketplace.
Coming up,
how can you go big without ruining what was great in the first one or what people loved in the older Rocky films?
Joining a Hollywood franchise on movie number 8. But first, let's do the numbers. In today's shortened trading day, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gave up 178 points, 0.7%, to close at 24,285. The NASDAQ shed 33 points, 0.4%, to end at 6938. And the S&P 500 fell 17 points, 0.6%, to finish at 2632. Oil prices were down also, falling to a one-year low on concerns about an excess of global supply. Holiday spending, though, got off to a strong start this Black Friday. Walmart picked up 0.9%, but other retailers struggled. Amazon discounted 0.9%, Target gave up 2.7%, Macy's contracted 1.7%. Bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.04%, and you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. As we mentioned at the top of the show, the UK and the European Union are still working out the exact terms of Brexit. One of the many still contentious issues, fishing. EU member states share fishing areas, but with the UK leaving the EU, that shared access will no longer be guaranteed. That could mean big changes for British and European fishermen. All of that to set up the latest entry in our once-in-a-while series called My Economy. This one comes from a fisherman in Glasgow, Scotland.
My name is Ronald Scordia. I'm working for Angel Bonds. We're exporting, you know, seafood, langoustine, lobster, you know, shellfish in general to France, Spain, Italy. I'm coming from France. I'm living in Scotland for 20 years. I have two children here, you know, and I'm very happy. I've always been involved with the fish industry. My dad was in the fish industry, so I keep going after him. We don't have any particular hours in our industry because we need to work when the products are there. So some day we can work few hours and some days, you know, we can work long hours. Brexit is very uncertain for us at the moment because nobody knows where that will go. The risk is very simple. You know, with the customs, we will lose the time to send our products. Because it's live and fresh products, we can afford to lose a day. So our quality will decrease and we'll have to go on the frozen market only. We need to be on the fresh and alive. You know, when you wake up, you're happy, you know, to talk to your customer daily and sell your products daily. Frozen market is a bit flat, you know, it's a bit boring. So we're reading so many articles, it's very confusing. I'm listening to the French news, the Scottish news also. Everybody contradicts, you know, and it's very difficult for me to understand what's happened in March next year. So it would be good, you know, if we have the answer very quickly. You know?
This series only works with your stories. Let us know how your economy is doing at marketplace.org. Disney's Ralph Breaks the Internet is looking like the big winner in this year's Thanksgiving box office battle. But MGM's Creed II is headed towards the best Thanksgiving opening ever for a live-action movie. That's according to The Hollywood Reporter. The film made almost $9 million yesterday and could earn $60 million or more by the time the weekend is done. Creed II is the eighth, yes, 8th installment in the Rocky franchise, and for director Stephen Caple Jr., it's a chance to jump from the world of small-budget indie films into a whole new ring. Stephen, welcome to the program.
No, thank you for having me.
What went through your mind when you got a call from MGM asking if you wanted to direct Creed 2?
Different emotions. I would call it a wave of emotions. First is exciting, right? When you're like, oh, man, I'm about to be a part of a huge franchise or have the opportunity to. And then the other is just nervousness. It's a sequel. You want to make sure it's good. How can you go big without ruining what was great in the first one or what people loved in the older Rocky films? All that was like running through my mind when trying to say yes to doing this project.
So how different is this from the films you've directed in the past?
It's different in many ways. I mean, one, I'm dealing with a lot of actors and established characters already, which I've never done before. Stuff I've done in the past, smaller independent film, you know, did the Sundance route and film festival circuit and ended up in a few theaters. And I've done some TV work. Now, you know, it's just a bigger scale, bigger project.
And a bigger budget, right? The Land, which was your last film, had a $1 million budget. Yeah. And Creed 2 had something like a $40 or $50 million budget. So how did that play out in terms of how you chose to direct the film?
You have to kind of go to the basics. I mean, when you get into a film that's just bigger in general and has a bigger scope and people are like, hey, we're going to try to sell it worldwide, there's certain markets and beats and moments within the film that you kind of want to hit. Usually they would say more explosions. But in this case, you know, it's more fights. And I think a big thing people don't consider is the fight sequences. They cost a lot of money. You know, visual effects, trying to sell the fact that you're in a stadium with 100,000 people, you know, that can definitely put a dent in the budget. But tonally, it's all about character. So you can't really get caught up in necessarily the hype or the money.
Where do we see you the most in this film?
I would definitely say the relationships. Tessa Thompson character and Michael B. Jordan. There's just small intimate moments, you know, between the two. And, you know, my style is a little different. I try to find a nice blend of genre and reality. But ultimately, I just go down to the heart. Like, at the end of the day, that's what it's about for me.
Films with black leads or even majority black casts are still pretty rare in Hollywood, even with the successes of movies mm-hmm. like The First Creed, Black Panther, Girls Trip. Why do you think that is?
Oh, man, I think just in general, not even just black, but even with female leads, you know what I mean? I think now is the time for us to like create this movement, and now we're having more of us behind the scenes. So you're starting to see more pictures like that now with Ryan Coogler being a executive producer on this, me being a director. I brought in a black writer named Joelle. You know, I think we're going to see these waves of films that are dealing with people of color and women that can sell on a universal market because we've proven it. We play a huge part in trending and what it means to be hip. And now you can track these things. You know, as before, I feel like it was a little harder. Now you have numbers everywhere. How many likes do you have? You know, how many comments do you have? Those are all examples of, you know, how we've transcended. You know, black people and women can sell films too.
At this point, how much does this movie's success at the box office matter to your career?
To my career?
Mm-hmm.
Probably a lot. Probably a lot. To me personally, I just want a good movie. I just want people to respond to it, you know what I mean, and relate. I'm not really chasing a number at all. You know, I think the studios are, obviously. Everybody wants to have a successful box office weekend. But for my career, you know, if it does well, I feel like people will start to respond more to me, the material I put out there, what I'm going to do next. It's kind of the nature of the beast, right? It's like this one step, and then next thing you know, the doors just flood open and everybody wants to do something. But I think I'm going to just continue to be myself, see who I connect with, what I connect with, and yeah, that's it. Pretty simple.
All right, Stephen Caple Jr. is director of Creed 2. The movie is out now. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And this final note on the way out, there are discounts all over the place on Black Friday, including many at animal shelters across the country, from $5 adoptions at the Hamilton County Humane Society in Indiana to Cat Friday at the ASPCA in New York City. And staying 100% on theme for Black Friday, the Maryland Society for the Protection of Animals waived the adoption fee today for all pets with black fur. You do still have to pay for their tags, though. And that's it for us. Today, the Dow gave up 178 points, the NASDAQ shed 33 points, and the S&P 500 fell 17.6 tenths of a percent. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. And I'm Kimberly Adams. Kai Ryssdal is back on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.